So one night in 2006, a man named Isaac Lidsky went out to eat dinner in a restaurant in Washington, D.C. He ate with his wife and a couple that were friends of theirs. And they had to wait a while in the bar, and then they walked through one room and went into another room and sat down. And the wife of the other couple stood up and said, I've got to find a bathroom. Did any of you notice where it was? And his wife said, I think it's around the corner across. And Isaac Lidsky said, No, that's not right at all. It's back through the room we walked through, and you'll find some stairs. It's at the bottom of the stairs. Everyone looked at him incredulous, or he felt their eyes upon him. And he said, he realized how he knew. As they walked in, he could hear the sounds of a bar. And then at the end of the bar, he could hear the slap of another patron going downstairs. He could smell her perfume, and he could feel a waft of moisture coming up from a badly ventilated space. And as they turned the corner, behind him, he could hear a toilet flush. And then they walked through the room, they sat down. He said, we were all a little surprised, myself included. I was also thrilled, as I realized in that moment the extent to which I was developing a new non-visual processing system for interacting with the world. And that wasn't really even the big surprise. What struck me was not the amount of information I could gain from non-visual senses. I had been devoting a lot of attention to that endeavor for years. What struck me was how natural the process had become, how rich the experience could be. Now today, I'm not here to put blind people on a pedestal and to say how wonderful and rich it is to be blind. But I am here to learn from the insights of three blind men and a woman who tried to walk in the dark, about how we see, how we can open ourselves up a little bit more from their experiences with vision. It struck me as interesting that the word vision both applies to eyesight and to mistaken eyesight, like the visions that appear that aren't really there, and also something larger, like our understanding, the trajectory of our lives. Isn't it interesting? It makes a lot of sense, because for people with eyes, we, according to a professor of medical optics in Rochester, New York, let me tell you, I found tons of statistics, but you can't trust the internet, so I think I can trust this one. More than 50% of the cortex, the surface of the brain, is devoted to processing visual information. We take 8% for touch and 3% for hearing. So we really are hearing dominating. Vision dominating. I think of myself as very auditory. I not only because I never can sit still because of my life, but because I like being read to. I always have a podcast or a book in one ear. But I'm 50% learning through vision and learning auditory. So most of us who have eyes to see use them. But Isaac Lidsky discovered, as he was losing his sight, that sight isn't the objective fact we think it is. So the three men lost their eyesight in different ways, which is an important realization to have. People considered blind have different abilities to see. Isaac could see as a young guy, and he was on a TV show. At 13, he reached the height of his acting career. He was on a show called Saved by the Bell 2. I think it's in between all of our lives. I'm not sure if any of us saw it. Anyone see that show? No. Oh, okay, yay, we have eight. but he was kind of like the Justin Bieber. They went to have fake pool parties. They spent a summer having fake PR. And when he was 13, that same year, his mother took him and his four older sisters to the eye doctor. One of his doctors, Ranit, had glasses. But one of his sisters, Daria, kept tripping and falling and crashing into things, and she was breaking important body parts. So they took all of them in. And he was annoyed because what's wrong with me? Why do I have to do this? By the end of the day, that poor mother found out two of her daughters and her son had a disease called retinosa pigmentosa. It's when your retina shreds. It's a genetic disease, and you get holes. And you know, for years, some people can see for decades, some people can't. So his eyesight went out in little drips and drops. He said it's like being in one of those big auditoriums or arenas where you're watching a game on a screen, and there are multiple little screens, and some of the screens wink out, but you can still see the picture. But eventually, more and more winked out. That was his story. But as he was learning about that, he discovered that eyesight is really constructed by our minds. We take in a tiny sliver of electromagnetic radiation that bombards them. It's like, he says it's like a 10 trillionth of all that bombards Earth. We don't see gamma rays, we don't see X-rays, we don't see ultraviolet light. There are some animals who see a larger spectrum than we do. It might be really cool if we could. But then I discovered Donald Hoffman, who had a TED talk about, do we see reality as it is? And he says, there's a reason we really don't see everything out there. The animals who see more and see more objectively die out faster than animals that just take in what they need to reproduce. That in studies of different types of animals and different types of extinctions, he seems to be making the case for not only do we not see everything out there, but there's a reason we don't. But most of us believe that what we see is there, and that it's real and it's objective and it's all-powerful and terribly important. And thank goodness for eyesight, because it does let us see danger from far off, further than many of our other senses. But as Isaac Lidsky discovered, we create what's in our mind. And because he was blind, he discovered as he was going blind that bits and pieces were falling out, and that what he thought was real wasn't. One day he was walking along in Harvard Yard where he was going to school, and a tree branch whizzed by him. He could see it. When he went back to look, it was still attached to the tree. He started to realize that he was losing his sight. Another person I'm going to talk about is Stephen Kuzisto. He's from New Hampshire. He's a poet, and he went blind as a baby, but in a different way. He had what was called premature retinopathy. So he was born, it's like he has Vaseline in his eyes. He was born seeing colors, and as he says, a torn geometry. He grew up in a household that would not let him say he was blind, because his parents had lived through the Depression. He was not allowed to show that he was blind, and so he had to learn every square inch of his town. He went to a college his father was president of, and he knew how many steps and where the holes were in the sidewalk. He knew how to get to the edge. He knew how far to walk to get to his mailbox. When he went to graduate school, he went ahead, 3 months ahead, to Iowa City so that he could map out the town in grids. And he said, when no one was looking, I'd pull out a telescope and read the street signs. I didn't want them to think I was deviant. The third person was born in 1924. His name was Jacques Lucerin, and he was a resistance fighter during World War II. He became blind at the age of 7. The only problem with his vision was corrected by glasses. But one day he was tussling with another boy who knocked him on his desk, and one part of his glasses went into his right eye and another part into his left. So his right eye was pierced by the arm, and his left eye had the retina torn. So when he woke up, he didn't have a right eye, and he didn't see out of the left. So at the age of 7, he went blind that way. What's really interesting is learning how they coped, how they learned new ways to adjust to their worlds. and over again with them, and with other people I've read, one of the most important things was their how their family reacted, was their inner light, their inner scene, how they felt about themselves. So Isaac Lidsky had this amazing mother. She had gotten him on the stage at a young age. She had gotten two of her other daughters into acting. And once she found out that three of her children were going blind, she started something called Miami Heart Sight. It was a group that was raising money to try to cure this disease. And he spent a lot of his teens and early 20s trying to raise money for that himself. He believed, because he had to, that there would be a cure. And he lived in a world where he had monsters and heroes. The monster was blindness. And at the age of 13, that day he found out about his diagnosis, he realized, well, my life's over. I will never marry. I will never work. I will live alone. I will live with my parents. He felt like he had a death sentence. And always in his mind, blindness was coming for him. When he had these heroes, the ones working on a cure, and the cure itself, and they would come and they would save him. Now he found a lovely young woman, and he got married. And her mother, Brenda, was an occupational therapist who started speaking to a young woman named Chris, who specialized in occupational therapy for the blind. And when they went on a trip, Brenda said, hey, let's go talk to her. She has some ideas about how. So Isaac went along because he knew he was going to be blind. And Chris asked him, do you use a cane? And he thought, this is about blindness. I don't need a cane yet. She said, okay, so do you walk into things? He says, what do you mean, do I walk here? And he showed her all the bruises from a fire hydrant. She said, so, you know, other people don't know you have problems with vision. Would it be helpful if they knew? Would it be helpful? He realized, yes. And then she went on to say, how about using your computer? How's that going? Well, it's really magnified, and I have a special cursor that's neon green, but I'm losing that now. So she told him there was a special program that could help him read text. It was hard to get to use, but once he learned it, he could use a computer. And so he left that place realizing there isn't blindness. There are fire hydrants and steps and cars, the things that he might walk into. And every day until he died, there would be ways to adjust to that and ways to cope and ways to move through it. He'd been waiting for this horrible monster to come and eat him up and take his life. And he realized he could go on living. He had an epiphany that seeing that way wasn't all important. In fact, he realized he needed to find other ways to see, not just in order to walk through the world, but in order to not limit himself. He realized that he had let fear close him in, that he needed to step back, get perspective. He also talked about learning about three rings that we live in. There's like a three-ring circus in all our lives. One of them is how we see ourselves. One of them is how we think other people see us. And one of them is the roles people try to put on us. And over again, both Stephen and Isaac talk about the roles people try to put on blind people, the weirdness Stephen had with trying to bring a seeing eye dog in an airplane. Just there are peculiar things that happen. The roles people put on you. But then there are these perceptions you have. You think other people think about you that may not even be real. And then there are your own. Over and over again, it is about how you face your inner life that helps you cope with the outer world. One day when he was older, Isaac Lidsky was asked by the Marlins to throw the pitch, the first pitch, right? And he thought, I've never been athletic. I couldn't have done that before, even when I had sight. I can't do this. And he thought, you know, if I did it, a friend would have to come up and do it for me, or I'd have to throw it ugly and wild. And then he thought, am I giving this up and giving blindness, you know, using it as an excuse to not do something I don't want to do? So he went out with his wife and his dog, and all of them had fun. She'd call ready, and he'd throw, and after several hours, he actually hit a strike. And when he did it, he hit a strike. Showing that so often, because sight is so important, we limit ourselves. And so many other things in our lives become facts that we don't have to be limited by. And most important of all, to step back from fear and to watch it. Now, Stephen Kusitso grew up in a very different family. He didn't have a cheerleader mom. He had a drinking mom. She kind of reminds me of my mom, my mom. She was very highly educated. She got into law school. But she was a post-World War II mother, and she stayed home with her children, so she began to drink. She hated being domestic so much that she got a 30-gallon trash can that stank, but she only had to empty it once. And she refused to let her son say he was blind. At one point, he decides to get a seeing eye dog. He's been working at his father's college, and they fire him. And he can't travel easily anywhere else. He can't, you know, go work at Walmart. A social worker sits across from him in his apartment and says, I know somebody who's making plastic lemons. You could make those. Otherwise, I don't see what you can do. And so he decided to get a seeing eye dog. But he was told in 3 weeks, someone was going to come and interview him and check his cane abilities. Now, just like Isaac, he hadn't used a cane. His mother hadn't wanted him to show any weakness in the world. Once in Italy, while he was in college, he rented a Vespa, because the man didn't even check licenses, and he followed someone ahead of him because he could see the bright red colors. He didn't see the beautiful, beautiful scenery, but thank God he survived. So he decided, I'm going to get a seeing eye dog, but I don't know how to use a cane. So some mobility expert came and showed him how to use the cane, and he discovered something really, really strange in the middle of that. He said, walking with a cane, I didn't desire acceptance in my time-honored way. If waving a blind man's stick wasn't precisely liberating, as no manufactured object should hold such potent significance in my view, he says, it was both useful and explanatory. In public, I was just who I was. There was no pretending, no grasping for admission to normal land. I pushed the cane from side to side, and for the first time in my life, I was in no immediate danger of being struck by a car. Moreover, I was powering a dynamo inside my head. A fanciful machine I pictured as throwing sparks, blue sparks, the electricity of forceful difference. My cane said I was unique, but assertively so. I didn't care what others thought. The arts of cane walking and street discernment were turning me, had turned me loose from the impressions of others. What a goddamn thing to discover, I thought. At 38, I'm done with creeping. Now, the third person who went blind at 7, Jacques Lucerin, had very different parents again. When he grew up in France in those days, they were sent to a special school, but it wasn't like the schools for the blind we have that equip people. It was more like an institution where you could learn how to cane chairs so you could keep yourself alive. But his parents insisted he stayed in regular education. They insisted he get this funny typewriter that had Braille, and his principal gave him a bigger desk so he could hold all of his equipment. And his father. So when Stephen Kusitso told his mother he was getting a guide dog, she said, oh, that's a bad idea. Everyone will know you're on the fritz. His parents, his father said, tell me if you see something new. He was very spiritual and very interested in this kind of adventure his son was making. And about a week after going blind, Jacques had this moment where he realized he could still see light. He'd still play with color, that was kind of fun, but light would well up in him and was very important. He also realized he could hear a lot in people's voices. Over the years, he was actually useful in the resistance because he decided to learn German. Everyone could see that Germany was growing and becoming more powerful under Hitler, but he did something about it so that by 1938, with the Anschluss, he could listen on the radio and know. But he also had a way of telling people's character by voice that served him well in terms of recruiting others into the resistance. When he was a child, he said, he had a teacher who walked in one day, and he found himself feeling really badly. The light inside him kind of dimmed, and he felt badly for the teacher. The teacher was lucid that day, as he usually was, perhaps more interesting than ever, a little too interesting. His voice, instead of falling into place at the end of the sentence as it should have, going down a tone or two down the scale, his voice hung in the air, a bit sharp. It was as though the teacher wanted to hide something that day, put a good face on it before an unknown audience, prove that he was not giving in, that he would carry on to the end because he had to. Meanwhile, accustomed to the cadence of his sentences falling as regularly as the beat of a metronome, I listened attentively and was distressed on his account. I wanted to help, but that seemed foolish, for I had no reason to thinking him unhappy. At the same time, he was unhappy, bitterly unhappy. The terrible intelligence of gossip told us a week later that his wife had just left him. That. And Lucerin talks about, since becoming blind, I've paid more attention to a thousand things. He talks about how when we use sight, we move too fast and we skim over things. But that he had to learn, so to get to know a piece of furniture, he would feel it. And he could feel the history of a piece of furniture. He could feel where it was grooved, so he knew it was handwork. And he could feel where in the last century, this is in France, a piece of it had fallen off and had been glued on. He could tell so much more because he was closer to things and not moving fast past them. Barbara Brown Taylor is an Episcopal priest who chose, and in her book she wrote How to Walk, Learning to Walk in the Dark, she chose to be in darkness because she feels that our churches too often separate into light and dark, and it's very simplistic. And if you keep on calling dark bad, what do people who have dark skin think of themselves? She says, many faith groups have a spirituality of full-on solarity, the bright sun of all the benefits they get from their faith, the Cadillacs they can pray into being, the certainty they have. She says, she has more of a lunar spirituality. It goes through phases. Sometimes it's full. Have you ever noticed in movies it's almost always full? Sometimes it's completely gone so you can see the stars. She goes through different types of certainty. And she stopped even serving in the parish ministry as a priest because the language just didn't mean anything to her anymore. She pointed out something I never understood before. She said, I always wondered why things take 3 days. Why was Jonah in the stomach of the fish for 3 days? Why does Easter happen 3 days later? Because of the moon. We wait 3 days for the new moon to come. She says, we've been practicing little resurrections forever. So she chose many different ways to be dark. She went into a cave. She went to a chain of restaurants called Opaque, started by a pastor in Switzerland who would bring people into his house and blindfold them and feed them that way so they'd have a more intimate meal, so they'd hear and smell and taste. And in Opaque, there's several, there's one in Tel Aviv, I think there's one in Los Angeles, you get blindfolded and they suggest, you know, wear dark clothes, wash your hands because you're gonna get rid of all your utensils. Finally, she spent a day in an installation. It was sort of an art exhibit museum installation where you spend the day being blind. And they had to follow people across the street. They had to go shopping in a mall. And after it was all over, she said, I was so happy to see again. says, it was amazing how being blind connected her to the other people. How, when they couldn't see, they couldn't tell how old they were, what color they were. They kept bumping into each other and having to apologize. They had to be vulnerable. They had to be intimate. She said, wouldn't it be great if we had a dark church where we recognize people not by name tags, but by the sound of their voice, where we go up and feel their faces. And there's an intimacy to using other senses than sight. That brings me back to this idea that sometimes we are limited by the way we see, the way we've always functioned. Sometimes it's really important to remember vision comes from many sources. Our eyes, our ears, our taste, our sense, but also our inner way of being. When Jacques Lucerin was arrested by the Gestapo, he had a period where he felt a lot of hate, and that inner light inside him darkened, and he started bumping into things. And when he pulled himself back, so for Isaac it was fear, for him it was hate and anger. When he gained perspective again, he started opening his mind, feeling the space, able to move again. For all of us, the inner nature of our hearts and being are incredibly important. When Stephen was getting a dog, he made sure that his self-esteem was in shape as well, because they didn't think any guide dog should have to carry that as well. And he'd spent his life with this alcoholic mother, being beaten up at school, being crazy at home. He had to learn how to prepare for that. So we all needs must do that in a way. Our vision isn't just this wonderful, incredible sight that we have. We can also see in other ways, and it's important we practice doing that. And we practice understanding where our heart is in all of that. Isaac says, you cannot hide from your heart. If you wish to create for yourself the reality you want to live, you will not see beyond your fears if you refuse to see that you're afraid. You will not silence your critic by plugging your ears. You will not test your strength with reason alone. Without acceptance, the disabilities we all possess breed surrender. But with acceptance, we can find strength in them. You will never be lucky if you cannot appreciate your luck. You cannot succeed if you have not defined your success. Human conversation takes its ideal form, bridge of language that can support the weight of ideas only when intention and effort are aligned. To feel loved, you must love yourself and others. To live and lead eyes wide open, you must live and lead heart wide open. And he had to learn to be vulnerable. One of his professors in law school said, you know, your blindness could be an asset. The jury will respond to you with empathy. And he said over the years, yeah, I could hear them reach out. It made things less formal. I didn't always win a case, but I could always get a table. Because the second time I go to a restaurant, I'm already a regular. They never forget that funny, quirky blind guy. And in his marriage, as they were engaged, he was becoming blind. They had to go through it together. He had to rely upon her. She had to speak her fears to him. When we want to see more clearly, when we want to connect more clearly, we also have to acknowledge our own vulnerabilities and put them out there. He says that losing his vision, he had to lose his sight to gain vision. And so I think today about, I want to explain to you why I picked Amazing Grace, not because I'm going to come out and beat you with it, this particular form of grace that you have to find. But each of these men found a kind of flow. That's what the Hungarian sociologist Mihai, I can never say his name, he calls it flow. They found a way of being in the world where they could be their best, where they could be connected. Stephen finds that with his guide dog. It's not like when you have to guide a horse. Dogs actually really help guide you. And Stephen found it the day he used his cane and realized, oh, I can live this way. I don't have to creep. And Isaac found it the day he realized fear was his monster, not blindness. All of them found a grace because of finding a different way of seeing. So that's what I hope to offer to all of you from these insights. Ways of seeing beyond, not discounting feeling, not discounting vision, but moving forward connected with who you are, using the tools you have as best you can.